All right, live show this morning. Happy 4th of July. Kelly here, and I'm going to try to make this as illuminating and as enjoyable as possible. The fact of the matter is there's a lot going on out there. I'm going to set that aside and I'm going to just go over the history of the country a little bit, the history of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. I'm going to try to throw everything in that I possibly can for you. I just read a survey that only 52% of the country is proud of America. And I think that's really scary to hear that, and that there would be something that would take away from the pride and the pleasure that we have in our country. We've got a fight on our hands internationally, but we've also got a fight on our hands nationally based on based on the fact that there's been a lot of people that have stirred up anti-American feelings in the population. So one thing at a time here, let's get to, I'll just give me a second and give you a few of the headlines. Hillary Clinton was interviewed over the weekend, I think maybe Friday. I can't remember the day. It had to be Friday, I believe. And she was, I guess, grilled by 8 different people. So we've got, nobody really knows what that would have been all about in direct detail. But we know in general it was about this email controversy that's going on. Some of your other news, there's been a lot of militant radical Islamic attacks across the globe, and there was one in Bangladesh that I think killed 200 people. Well, there's one in Bangladesh. Actually, that one I don't think killed 200, but I believe there was a bombing in Iraq that killed 200 people. There was an attempted attack at the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia. And there was a gentleman who tried to go after some public buildings in Tucson. So we've got it all across the world jihad, and it's raises the sense of alarm a little bit. Today's weather, well, let me just say the temperature right now, 72 degrees, and it should be a high of 102. Doesn't look like much of a chance of rain today, but there might be tomorrow. All right, let's dig into some of this stuff that I've got for you, because I think we've got 2 hours here. I did an interview with Steve Pierce, but I think I'm going to hold that off till tomorrow. 523-1450 and 805-6180 is your text line. I was going to do a show for today, when you're working in the radio industry, the difference between making a show for a talk show versus a show for a music show is totally different. So probably take me 4 or 5 hours to put the show together. And I just thought I'll come in and do it live since I'm in town. All right. Here's a little bit to start off on the war for independence, 1775, 1783. So we've got 13 colonies and people from different places, mostly Europe, England, and Dutch, little French, German, but mostly British individuals here. And here is just a broad outline of the war for independence, starting in 1775, and starting off on tax protests.
Thank you. America's war for independence was tremendously important because it made it possible for a new form of government called democracy to come into the world at a time when almost everyone was still being ruled by kings and queens. The war for independence was a long, hard-fought struggle between the professional army of Britain, the most powerful country on earth, and a raggedy collection of American colonists. It lasted for 8 long years, and by the time the war was over, 27,000 American and 10,000 British soldiers had lost their lives. As the leaves were just changing color in October of 1774, the colonies were experiencing a lot of trouble because of unfair taxation, lack of representation in the British Parliament, and the restriction of colonial freedoms. Even so, less than one-third of the colonists really wanted independence from Britain. Nevertheless, the First Continental Congress was meeting that October and was warning people to be prepared to fight if American liberties were not restored. Early in the next year, in 1775, the situation grew worse when the king declared the colony of Massachusetts to be in open rebellion and commanded that Boston's main patriot leaders, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, be arrested for treason. A short time later, soldiers were ordered to seize American weapons and gunpowder being stored in the town of Concord, Massachusetts. The night before the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, the steeple of this Boston church glowed with the light of 2 lanterns. The lights were a signal to the patriots that British troops, known as redcoats, were coming to search for weapons in Concord by secretly crossing the river to Charlestown. Once they knew which way the redcoats were coming, 3 riders, including a silversmith named Paul Revere, raced off to warn people along the way. The next morning, here in Lexington, Massachusetts, 70 armed citizens known as Minutemen confronted the redcoats as they marched toward Concord. No one knows who fired the first shot, but when it was over, 8 Minutemen lay dead. The British troops continued on toward Concord, but when they got here, to the old North Bridge, more fighting erupted, and they retreated back toward Boston. But all the way back, they were fired upon by rebels from behind trees and stone fences. By the time the Battle of Lexington and Concord was over, 250 British soldiers and 90 Americans had been killed or wounded. A few weeks after the outbreak of war, representatives from the 13 colonies formed the Second Continental Congress that would serve as an emergency government throughout the war. While the Second Congress was just getting underway here at the State House in Philadelphia, the war spread as American fighters in the colony of New York captured Fort Ticonderoga. At the same time, armed militias took up positions in the hills around Boston. By the middle of June, Congress had authorized the formation of a Continental Army, and they selected George Washington to be its commander and chief. The Battle of Bunker Hill was the second and the bloodiest battle of the Revolutionary War. It started after American militiamen constructed a crude dirt fort at night atop a hill in Charlestown, overlooking Boston's harbor. In the morning, the British began shelling the fort from ships in the harbor and from land batteries in Boston. Soon, Charlestown was burning. Then wave after wave of redcoats attacked, but the poorly equipped Americans didn't start firing until they could see the whites of the enemy's eyes. The battle continued until the militiamen ran out of gunpowder. In the end, the redcoats suffered twice as many casualties as the Americans, but the British still managed to win the bloody Battle of Bunker Hill. A month after the American defeat at Bunker Hill, General Washington took command of the militias around Boston. His plan was to drive the Redcoats from the city if Britain refused to accept America's offer of peace. When he learned the king had declared war on all the colonies, Washington went into action. He gave orders to have many cannons brought in from far off Fort Ticonderoga. But the only way this could be done was to wait for snow in order to drag the heavy guns on sleds to Boston. As this was being done, American troops invaded British Canada, but were defeated when they tried to capture the city of Quebec. By March of 1776, the cannons were in Boston and were pointed directly at the enemy. Realizing their position was hopeless, the British dumped their own cannons into the harbor and sailed off to the safety of Canada. After that, American forces took control of the city. With the arrival of summer in 1776, Thomas Jefferson and other members of a special congressional committee were busy at work writing the Declaration of Independence, America's most famous historical document. They wrote that all men are born with certain God-given rights and are created equal. They describe all the ways that Britain had taken away the rights of the colonists, and they declare that America must be independent to form a new democratic nation. The United States of America was born here, within the walls of the State House of the Colony of Pennsylvania, on the 4th of July, 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was presented to Congress. This room was unusually quiet that day, as men stepped forward to sign their names to the document, for all of them realized the great importance and danger of what they were doing. Among the signers of the Declaration of Independence, slavery was a very controversial and confusing issue, for while some hated slavery, others were slave owners. Still others were slave owners who also hated slavery.
Well, let's take a little break here. It is 6:19. It's in the 70s already. It's going to be a little bit over 100 degrees. You're listening to AM Las Cruces, special live 4th of July broadcast. I'm going to try to fit as many things as I possibly can into this, into these 2 hours. And, you know, I've already discovered and learned a lot from just putting the material together. So, as I always do, it's 6:20, and the number to call in 523-1450 and 805-6180 is your text line. Here's the Gaither Vocal Band Star Spangled Banner a cappella.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous sky, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming.
Kelly, it's 6:23, doing a special live 4th of July show. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed about this bombing in Bangladesh, and the New York Times went into this a great deal, it turns out the scions of the society, the upper class children, the boys, these boys that went to these special prep schools, private schools, the elite children were the ones that led this bombing attack. So what they're afraid of is that this ISIS is becoming you know, it's becoming popular with, you know, that class of people, which would be a deadly maneuver, then it's not just this ragtag bunch of malcontents. It becomes, you know, part of the popular thinking, and then we've got real chaos on our hands. But we already do have a terrible, terrible threat to world liberty, and it's extremely sad that we've taken the direction that we have, because this war on terror has been mishandled, I would say, since the time of Bush. Anyway, 624, and we'll continue on for the War of Independence, just talking right here about how they dealt with slavery.
Thomas Jefferson, for example, had called slavery a cruel war against human nature. Yet both he and George Washington, who also held anti-slavery views, possessed large Virginia plantations and owned hundreds of slaves. The Continental Congress believed that the problem of slavery had to be solved at a later time, because right then, the war had to be won and a strong union of states created. Many Americans were just learning that independence had been declared when war broke out in New York and spread to New Jersey and Pennsylvania. It began when British soldiers and hired German troops, called Hessians, assembled to attack New York City. After a lot of fighting, British forces took control of the city and chased Washington's army across New Jersey into Pennsylvania. But near here, on Christmas night in 1776, Washington and his men went on the offensive. They crossed the icy Delaware River and slipped back into New Jersey. With the element of surprise on their side, American forces went on to win important battles at Trenton and nearby Princeton. The next summer, a huge enemy force invaded New York from Canada. At the same time, a second British force attacked from the opposite direction and defeated Washington's army in Pennsylvania in a battle at Brandywine Creek. From there, the British marched on and took Philadelphia, America's capital city. But up north in New York, near the town of Saratoga, things went much better for the United States, because forces led by General Horatio Gates beat the British twice and captured a large number of enemy soldiers. The Saratoga victories were very important. In fact, because of them, France decided to enter the war on the side of the United States. 2 months after the fighting at Saratoga, Washington began to set up his winter encampment here at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, about a day's ride from Philadelphia. Soldiers built rows of log cabins like these, and in a short time, the Valley Forge encampment became the second largest city in the United States, with a population of 12,000 men. Although the cabins were very crowded inside, they provided shelter from the snow and wind. But Washington's men still suffered severe hardships most of that winter because they lacked adequate food, shoes, and clothing. And by spring, 2,000 soldiers had died. However, some good happened at Valley Forge as well, for a German officer named Baron von Steuben drilled and trained the American troops until they became a much more disciplined and determined fighting force. In 1778, the summer after Valley Forge, the British undertook a major military campaign in the southern states, where a lot of people were against independence. So the British abandoned Philadelphia, and soon warfare ended in the north. Late in December of 1778, the King's forces seized Savannah, Georgia, and soon took control of the whole state. The year 1779, as well as most of 1780, were very bad for the United States, because they suffered a string of bitter defeats in the South. Eventually, the Americans started to win again, but they could not stop the British from invading Virginia. By October of 1781, a large force of British troops, led by General Cornwallis, had reached Yorktown, Virginia, an old tobacco port near the Chesapeake Bay, where the last battle of the Revolutionary War was to be fought. On the outskirts of Yorktown, the British set up an encampment, positioned their weapons, and built walls and trenches while they waited for more supplies and troops to arrive in ships from New York. While this was going on, Washington's army and 5,000 French troops marched south to Virginia. When Washington reached Yorktown, he learned some very good news. A French fleet had battled the ships coming to help the enemy's army and had forced them to turn back. This meant the British were trapped and outnumbered. Besides that, relentless shelling by American and French troops was causing them very heavy casualties. It was such a hopeless situation for the British that on October 19, 1781, the shooting stopped and they surrendered. The battlefield here at Yorktown witnessed the last big conflict of the Revolutionary War, but the war did not officially end until 1783, when a peace treaty was approved in which Great Britain formally recognized the independence of the United States of America.
Yeah, baby. All right, so we'll take another break here and come back, and I'm going to give you some of the factors leading up to the American Revolution. And here's a little more from the Gaither Vocal Band. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 to call in, 805-61802. Text, you're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE, a live show just for you. For the people that are tuning in, I want to make it as special as possible and pack as much info in here. So stay on your toes. We'll be right back at 6:31 on the 4th of July, 2016.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, deep blue through the night, that our flag was still there.
All right, so around the same time, the time that we're fighting the Revolutionary War, I want you guys to remember this. You might ask questions as, how is it possible that we signed off on slavery? It's so obviously a ridiculous and a terrible doctrine. How did it get into our founding papers and such? And I think that lady had mentioned one of the issues there. One of the issues was that there was slave owning, and, you know, there were people that, don't forget the people that fought the Revolutionary War. This is kind of extraordinary, not a ragtag group of people, but the leading lights of the society, some of which were large landowners. I believe that George Washington was either one of the wealthiest or the wealthiest people in America, in the colonies at that time. So, you know, these guys with these plantations had a dilemma. You know, are you going to get slaves and cut down on the cost of running your plantation, even though you might be opposed to it because it's legal? I mean, of course, I'm not going to defend it, but I'm just going to explain it to you. Before we get into the causes, I want to get into the foundation of what the Constitution was built on. A Constitution, the idea of a Constitution was new. John Locke and other thinkers came up with this idea of a law beyond the law, a law above the law. So you could say that in the same way the Ten Commandments is kind of the law above the law in the Bible, the Constitution, in a secular sense, is the law above the law in America. It's the first modern constitution and obviously successful. We've still got it. But here's a little bit on the background. Hadley Arks is a professor at Amherst, and he's an expert on constitutionalism, natural law, and these type of things. Check this out. This is about 3 minutes.
The first question that perplexes political life is the justification for the political order itself, because the political order is characterized by the presence of law, the capacity to make decisions that are binding on people, even when it means overriding their private choice.
I just want to point out this guy has been extremely influential in his publishing and such. So he's an important scholar in America.
Personal taste, the personal freedom, and replacing that freedom with a public rule. And all the great political theorists have raised the question, how do we justify that state of affairs, which some men are invested with the authority to rule others with the force of law? Now, when we come to the Constitution, the terms of principle in which people are governed, the first question is, well, how do we justify that state of affairs? And John Locke raised the question in this way. He said, what is the source of that positive law, not the negative law, the law that is positive, enacted in any particular place? Well, the source of the positive law is the legislature that is authorized to act. And then he asks, well, what is the source of the legislature? What establishes the legislature? The answer, the Constitution, which establishes it. You may have a legislature, or a legislature of two houses, no legislature. Then he raised the question, what does the Constitution depend on? We said it must be some source anterior to the positive law, before you have a positive law. And that must depend on the natural right of human beings to be ruled with their own consent. So before we even have a constitution, you have to begin with a rightful ground of governance over human beings and the ground in which we have a constitution. And of course, what it does is alert us to those things we've taken as principles of the Constitution that were there before we made our Constitution. Principles that don't depend at all then on whether they are mentioned in the Constitution, like the principle on ex post facto laws. There's a big argument at the beginning of whether it's worth even mentioning ex post facto laws in the Constitution, because James Wilson and Oliver Ellsworth said, well, everyone knows that. No need to mention it. Ex post facto laws is that people should not be held punishable for something pronounced a crime after the act was permitted, or a situation in which you enlarge the penalties for something that was thought wrongful earlier on, or presumed innocent until proven guilty. Now, that was thought to be bound up with the very logic of a regime of law. Now, I've heard one lawyer arguing before the Supreme Court saying that, Mr. Justice Scalia, I want to fall back on my right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, my constitutional right, but of course, presumed innocent until proven guilty is nowhere in the Constitution. But we take it to be there because it is bound up with the first principles of a regime of law.
All right, that's Hadley Arks. Let me play, because this is a little bit dense, the beginning of the causes of the American Revolution at 6:38, Kelly O'Connell. And this is kind of interesting. He's got both the short-term and long-term causes of the U.S. Revolution.
Video with Mr. Paper Barlow High School. Today we're looking at the causes of the American Revolution. Our essential question for today is, what were the long and short-term causes of the American Revolution? Let's look at the long-term causes first, going back a while. The First Great Awakening. In the early 1700s, the First Great Awakening is going to be a religious revival that occurs. It is going to be the rise of a bunch of new American, or predominantly American, denominations. It is going to be a breaking away from the Church of England, also called the Anglican Church. With this happening, the Anglican Church being headed by the King of England, the Anglican Church being directly tied to the British government, as people are breaking away from the Church of England to other denominations, they have their own kind of religious awakening, and they're not as tied. It's like fracturing the bond a little bit, okay? The Enlightenment, you've got Locke and Hobbes, okay, from Great Britain itself. You've got Rousseau and Montesquieu, and you have people basically that are these philosophers theorizing ideas about having a republic and how monarchy is wrong and people should be able to get rid of a bad government. These things, as these ideas percolate and become more widespread, and the American population is pretty well read, as these things are well read, become spread, you're going to see, again, people start to question authority a little bit more. The French and Indian War, you got several things going on. Number one, the French and Indians, okay, the Indians fight on both sides, but the French are against the British. It's a battle for Pittsburgh and the wider Ohio River Valley. It spreads into a global war, and the French lose. The British win. Several things going on. The American colonists get some fighting experience in this, and some of them become like junior officers like George Washington. They also have exposure to the very brutal, harsh treatment of the British officers and generally what they consider the immoral, bad behavior of the British soldiers. Going back to the First Great Awakening, they see themselves kind of like morally superior. The bond is continuing to dissolve. So leaving the French Indian War, the good thing for the British is they take basically Canada and don't have conflict in the Ohio River Valley. The French are removed from North America.
All right. So the Great Awakening sets the table for the American Revolution, because what happens is you have a revolution in the churches in America, this first Great Awakening. The Great Awakening puts out a lot of principles in the pulpits that are later picked up by the political writers. And so you've got this kind of dialectic, this kind of back and forth between the churches and the political system, developing certain ideas of freedom. And it produces a ferment. It's a very rich and powerful mixture. We'll take a break here. 6:42, right now, talking about the causes of the American Revolution. You're listening to AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, a special live 4th of July show, and 523-1450 to call in, and 805-6180. We'll come back to the causes of the American Revolution. It's Kelly here, and we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Donna, and I want to thank you so much for covering the history of our Revolutionary War on your radio. I'm listening to it now, and I really appreciate the fact that you're getting the history out. And one thing I'd like to point out, that there were 56 signers of our Declaration of Independence, but only 15 of those signers were slave owners. So I think people, you know, need to realize that.
Thank you, Donna. Happy 4th.
You too.
Okay,
bye-bye.
All right, folks. Donna, we've had our ups and downs, but we're having an up period. But anyway, so look, slavery was a worldwide issue. It still is a worldwide issue. There's more slaves now than there were at any time in history. People don't understand this. It's a continuing battle for freedom, and we're in the middle of a fight for freedom against Islam, and what are we going to do about it, you know? Are we going to really get just sit there and get our lunch handed to us every day? We've got to approach this struggle as a, not just a political struggle, but as a religious struggle. The Muslims want us to understand it's a religious struggle. We need to pick that up. In Islam, there is no freedom, believe it or not. I should just do a show on that. Anyway, here's a little more on the causes of the American Revolution. This is post the war between the British and the French over America.
But the problems are they have a massive amount of debt from the war now, and they have increased costs to operate North America because they have a lot more land. Now they have to basically try and make sure that French population in Canada is going to work with them. They've got Native Americans to deal with, and of course, keeping the peace with the British and American colonies. So they've got these extra costs and this debt to deal with, and these are significant issues for them. So the question becomes how to pay off this debt. And the solutions end up becoming some of the short-term British actions. So let's go ahead and look at those. The British actions. First one, Proclamation of 1763. The idea here is that the colonists would not be allowed to move from beyond, well, from east of the Appalachian Mountains west and traverse across them. Why? Because Native Americans were out to the west and they were going to fight. And the British are saying, we don't want that increased cost. So they cut a deal with Pontiac and the other Native American leaders saying, we promise, if you promise us peace, we will not allow the colonists to move out to the west. One of the main reasons the colonists fight in the American, the French Indian War is they want to move west. So this is a slap in the face after they've served on the winning side. Results in colonist anger. So they're trying to limit cost here. It's a cost-saving measure. Sugar Act. Okay, the Sugar Act. Now, sugar obviously is a pretty popular thing today. It certainly was back then. But basically what had happened is, remember we talked in a previous video about those navigation acts put into place, but then solitary neglect happens. They don't enforce them well. From really 1650 until the end of the French and Indian War in 1763. And with that, now they're saying we need to clamp down. This is a way to like squeeze some more money out of existing revenue sources. Let's stop smuggling. What did the Navigation Act say? Well, for instance, if you have somebody in the United States, or the American colonies, I should say, they would have to come up to Great Britain before they could go trade anywhere else in Europe. They would have to sail up here and only trade with the British or with British colonies, say, in the West Indies, or they would have to stop and pay the British some money before they went somewhere else. Either way, it's raising the costs for the British of operating, okay? Excuse me, for the American colonists because of the British's policy. Also, they start, so what do the Americans do? They try and smuggle. Instead of going there, they try and avoid the British Navy and go trade wherever they want. Well, they get away with this for, you know, to a large extent for quite a while. So the Sugar Act is designed to stop this and punish those smugglers. Writs of assistance. If you got caught as a smuggler, you would go to a vice admiralty court, which means instead of a jury of your peers, say in Massachusetts, in Boston, you might go up into British Canada and have a military tribunal court, basically. And that was not going to be very sympathetic to you. You get the hammer dropped on you. Also, general warrants. General warrants were the idea that you would have like a search warrant, but it never ended and it was for anything.
All right. So we'll take a little break here and come back and pick up the rest of the problems that caused the American Revolution. 649, and this is the Gaither Vocal Band singing Star Spangled Banner, and we'll be right back to finish up the source of the American Revolution in terms of the argument that is mentioned in the Declaration of the it's which is basically a Dear John letter from the colonists to the British. So here is the end of this discussion, which will start to bring up things that you've heard of, including the Stamp Act, the Townsend Act, and stuff. These taxation acts that caused the founders to decide they couldn't take it anymore. Causes of the American Revolution.
United States today, it has to be specific to the time, the place, what you're looking for.
And he's talking about putting out an arrest warrant
for what your probable cause is, approved by a judge. Once this general warrant was in place, it never ended, and it was for anything related to a person. It wasn't a specific place, one time, or anything. This is going to be a direct cause of the Fourth Amendment, okay? Again, colonist anger is going to emerge. John Hancock, he's a smuggler. Whose name's biggest on the Declaration of Independence? John Hancock. He wanted to stick it to the British and make a point. Stamp Act. Okay, the Stamp Act is now a direct tax that the British put on the Americans. And every time you would have a paper document, playing cards, newspaper, magazine, book, whatever, there would be a legal document. You would have to pay a stamp tax and put a stamp on there to show that you had actually paid that thing. Well, This is going to result in a wide variety of colonist responses. Stamp Act Congress, you're going to have colonies getting together, and they write a unified statement rejecting the stamp tax, saying taxation without representation, it's unfair, and blah, blah, blah. Sons of Liberty. Sons of Liberty are going to be, you know, kind of this guerrilla group that's going to launch some attacks and destroy property and intimidate and basically gum things up for the British quite a bit. They form, and then you're going to have boycotts. The colonies are going to say, fine, we're not buying anything British. Well, that's going to be the most effective weapon of all, because now, oh, they also, the Sons of Liberty are like attacking the tax collectors, tar and feathering them, burning their houses down. So they intimidate them so no one even collects the tax, basically. The boycotts make the British manufacturers mad at the British government, so they pull the tax off. 2 years later, Townshend Acts. This is another attempt, but instead of the direct tax that you see as you buy the product, now this is an offshore tax placed on before the goods came ashore on raw materials such as glass and tea and some other products. And so the Townshend Acts, again, it's another way to try and collect taxes. The Stamp Act, Townshend Act, the Tea Act, you're talking about generating new revenue to pay down that debt from the French and Indian War. Townshend Act results in forming of committees of correspondence. This is bad for the British because it is going to be communications that are kind of permanent between the colonies about problems with the British. So it's an us versus them mentality, gaining more traction, becoming more entrenched. Sons of Liberty and boycotts reemerge, and the British are forced to pull off the Townshend Act as well. Tea Act. They decide to leave the tax on tea, and they even drop the price a little bit to help out a struggling major company called the East India Trading Company, okay? But the Americans know they're still being taxed. The British are trying to keep alive the principle of taxation. So this results in the Boston Tea Party done by the Sons of Liberty. Sons of Liberty do this. It actually alienated some Americans. They're like, you guys are idiots. You're going too far. Until the coercive acts happen, the British punishment is very strong. The coercive acts shut down Boston Harbor. They dissolved the Massachusetts colonial legislature, and they had military occupation of Boston until they paid back this money. So the hammer's dropped. Now, the British purpose here is to teach a lesson. If we punish them harshly, no one will ever dare to do this again. But that's not how it's received. Everyone else looks at it like, hey, if they're doing this right now, we're next. It's going to happen to us regardless. They're dropping the hammer. They're stealing all of our liberties. We can't accept this. The boycotts return. You have a homespun movement that kind of started happening up here, but it's really going to kick into gear. You have women like making homemade clothes, sending them to Massachusetts. Foodstuffs being sent to Massachusetts, and you have these committees of correspondence going on with more of a permanent air, discussing the issues with the British in different areas. First Continental Congress is going to be a result of the committees of correspondence, and the biggest thing that First Continental Congress does is they form what's called the association. This is a permanent boycott system among all the colonies. So things are going from bad to worse. As all of these things are happening, searching for the Sons of Liberty and stashes of weapons, you eventually get Lexington and Concord and the Second Continental Congress. In Lexington and Concord, of course, you have bloodshed that goes down, and you know now hostilities are kind of violently commenced. The Second Continental Congress is going to come in, and now you're getting into Bunker Hill, and the colonists are going to come out with the Olive Branch Petition. And I think you know there are other things that they introduced, but this is really the most important one because you still had a faction of American colonists that were loyalist, and you had another faction that were kind of on the fence, and then you had a faction that were patriot. The ones that were kind of on the fence, they went with the loyalists and said, let's appeal to the king to just go back and have a do-over. So they actually say that, king, our issue is with Parliament, not with you. We still want you to be our king. Let's have a big do-over. Tell Parliament to get rid of these onerous taxes. Let's go back to the way things work. The king rejects it out of hand, won't even listen to it. And this is going to sway those fence sitters and even a few of the most moderate loyalists to go to the patriot side. And once that happens, revolution becomes inevitable.
All right. So we'll take you out here with the Gaithers and come back and talk about the Constitution and Bill of Rights. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450 to call in 805-6180 at 659. on the 4th of July. It's great to be an American, isn't it?
My life's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we
All right, so you've got in the middle of this war, America decides there's no going back. And so they put together the Declaration of Independence, which is certainly one of the greatest documents ever penned. And you see it as a couple of different things, one of which is a statement to the British as to why America decided to do this. And the second one is an introduction to the Constitution. So here's a little bit from the History Channel.
The Declaration of Independence, for me, is one of the best pieces of writing I've ever seen.
It's a revolutionary document for a revolutionary statement.
You cannot help but be stirred when you read those words.
Thomas Jefferson's writing is absolutely magnificent. And when he wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," that was the first time anybody had bothered to write that down.
And then you turn the clock back and think of when he was writing, how young he was, what a statement it was, given the history of the world at that point. And you feel the excitement of being on the cusp of something so profound that it's hard to put it into words.
If you review our Declaration of Independence, it has those beautiful words about all men are created equal and governments are formed among men to represent the people. It's a good statement of what we're all about. And that's the only thing people remember about the Declaration of Independence, that it was about all men are created equal. But it's really a roughly a 28-count indictment against King George. And therefore, because of the way in which the British Crown treated us, we now declare that we are a free country, and we want to let you know why. Now, we're going to have a war. We're going to have a war.
In 1776, you have the Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia, debating a unified position for the colonies with respect to the hostilities that have already broken out. And the fundamental issue between them is, are they fighting for their rights as Englishmen within the British Empire, or are they going to fight for independence? And they're seriously divided. People who are perfectly willing to resist the tyranny of the British government are not necessarily willing to strike for independence. But there's a groundswell in favor of it, I think, in large measure, because they recognize that having provoked the lion this far, there's no going back.
All of a sudden, you have this group of people who are going, no, we're not part of some great chain of being with the king at the top of it. We are free people. We can vote for who we want to have in charge. And we're not going to tolerate you telling us that we have some class status we have to be trapped in. It says, you know, we are endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights, meaning that Parliament in London, the king himself, the courts cannot interfere and take away your rights, because the state can't take power from us. So even to this day, it's probably the most central difference between America and every other country in the world.
It goes well beyond what was needed in order to declare independence. It establishes a philosophical basis for a civil democracy in which all persons are guaranteed rights by virtue of their personhood.
This political genius, not just in Jefferson, but in Adams and all the other people who collected here, they saw a new time for humankind, which is that we can be free and that we can make decisions for ourselves.
So, you know, Adams was as much, or James Madison, he's talking about Adams, I think, but James Madison is as much a genius as Jefferson. So here is a little introduction to the U.S. Constitution in your a 1 minute introduction.
Hey guys, welcome to Hip Hughes History. I want to tell you what the U.S. Constitution is. It really is the rule book for the United States of America. It was written to replace the Articles of Confederation, our first failing constitution, at the Constitutional Convention of 1787. The U.S. Constitution is made up of seven articles. The first three articles are really focused on limiting the government by separating powers and creating checks and balances, making it very difficult for the federal government to do big things. We also have federalism being defined, the relationship between the states and feds, and Articles 4, 5, and 6. We also have strength components in the U.S. Constitution, mainly Article 6, the Supremacy Clause, which makes it the law of the land. And we also have the Elastic Clause and the Interstate Commerce Clause, which gives the federal government some flexibility to engage with its delegated powers. But we also have tremendous flexibility when it comes to Article 5 of the Constitution, which allows us to change it. It comes with a pencil and an eraser. How about that? If you want to know more about the Constitution, which you better.
All right. So here is a group of actors reading the Declaration of Independence. And starting off with Mel Gibson, who I assume would not be invited today. Check this out.
And in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them.
Excuse me, I think I've got a box that's popped up here. All right, so let's take a little break here, and I'll be right back and fix that. 713, Kelly O'Connell. We'll come back to a reading of the Declaration. All right. So let's, how about this? Why don't we go through, if I have time, I'll finish up with the reading the declaration. Here is five key concepts everyone should know about the U.S. Constitution.
Hello, this is the U.S. Constitution, five key concepts everyone should know, part one. Please watch part two after viewing this part one. Hello, my name is Craig Seibert, and this short web seminar is titled The U.S. Constitution, five key concepts everyone should know. And if you're an international listener, please stay with us as we take a look at this key founding document for the United States of America and look at its concepts. 90% of today's Americans have never heard what you're about to hear. In the late 1700s, however, 90% of Americans had a basic understanding of the concepts in this web seminar. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States and author of the Declaration of Independence, said this: "The price of freedom is eternal vigilance." And so we hope, as we look at these concepts, a new enthusiasm for freedom and understanding the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence will stir in the hearts and soul of the listeners. So the first concept that we want to talk about is the fact that the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution work together. And there's actually a short web seminar on this topic, but to summarize, the Declaration of Independence serves as the charter or the purpose document for the United States, why the United States was founded and on the core principles on which it was founded. And then the U.S. Constitution serves as the bylaws for the United States. That is, it's our organizational document and how we'll govern ourselves. And so this is a key concept that the Declaration and the Constitution work together and that the Constitution acts on the principles and beliefs that are written in the Charter for the United States, that is the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, of course, was signed July 4th, 1776. It was over 11 years later that the U.S. Constitution was pulled together, and this graphic is just simply to show the difference in size of the two documents, the Declaration being about 1,400 words long and the Constitution being about 4,500 words long. Finally, there's an additional part of the Constitution not shown here that was added shortly after the initial ratification or during it, and that is the Bill of Rights, and it is a concise listing of the rights of the citizens of the United States as well as the rights of the states. And there's 10 items in the Bill of Rights. Now, as a next step, let's take a look at understanding the basic structure of the main body of the Constitution. And here we show what is typically viewed by people as the first and main page. The first key concept is this: the total length of the United States Constitution is over 4,500 words. About 4,000 of these words describe how the three branches of government are to operate, and we'll take a look at that. And then another 400 words describe the relationship between the states and the process for making amendments to the Constitution. Here in this diagram, we show how these three branches of government are broken up, both by way of sequence, but also how much text of the Constitution is dedicated to each of the three branches. The first branch that's listed in the U.S. Constitution is the legislative branch called Congress, and there's two parts of the legislative branch, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they are identified in Article 1 of the Constitution and listed here. It's interesting to note that the House of Representatives is discussed first, then followed by the Senate. And as we'll discuss later, there's significance in this sequence in that the founders believed that the House of Representatives would be the slightly more powerful of the three branches because it was closest to the people. There would be a balance of powers, but the House of Representatives has some unique characteristics and responsibilities. The second branch of government that's listed is the executive branch, beginning down here and then up into this section here. The third branch of government is the judicial branch, the Supreme Court, and then the remaining part of the government or Constitution deals with the relationship between the states and the process for making amendments. What might be lost in this process, though, is the importance of the first 52 words. We've looked at the document as it's been bracketed in this fashion, but if you look at the first 52 words of the Constitution, you'll find that these are the most important. And the first 52 words are literally contained in this small box here. And so as you can see, by way of quantity of words, 52 words out of 4,500 is not many, and yet they're the most important words in the Constitution. They state the six core purposes for which the Constitution was written. These six core purposes serve to define and limit the remaining 4,450 words of the Constitution. And so these words are so important that they literally dictate what the rest of the Constitution should be guided by way of interpretation. And as I had said previously, this Constitution also is interpreted or built upon the Declaration of Independence. And so the flow would be from the Declaration to these 52 words, and those two things then in turn would interpret the rest of this document. Well, what do those first 52 words say? We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. Now, for the sake of simplicity and clarity, let me reduce these even further so you can see the six aspects. We the people of the United States, in order to connect the states together, to establish justice, to ensure peace, to provide for defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure liberty now and in the future. These are the six aspects of what the rest of the Constitution is designed to support and to guide. Let me also note here that to promote the general welfare, as it would have been understood in 1787, did not mean the modern government welfare programs of today. What that meant was to create a fair economic playing field that all parties that were citizens of the United States could have access to use their gifts, skills, abilities, and talents to pursue the dreams and goals that they had in life. But not the government handouts that we associate with welfare today. As I've said already, everything else in the Constitution is supposed to serve only these six purposes. As citizens of the United States, we need to memorize these first 52 words. What a difference it would make. To continue this.
All right, so let's take a little break here. Dense material. Here's a little bit of Yankee Doodle Dandy for you. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523 1450 to call in, and 805-618. Oh, we'll come back and hear the second half of the five important concepts out of the U.S. Constitution. All right, just to let you know, the weather's mid-70s right now, 73 degrees, going to be up to 102, 103 today in the United States. From the border of New Mexico and Arizona up to Canada, isolated thunderstorms, not really over us, but about half or two-thirds of the state covered by that on the top. Diagonally cut across there, and then you have very strong thunderstorms in the center of America on the right side to the eastern seaboard from Florida all the way up to looks like almost Maine. So could be more flooding in West Virginia. Here is the second part of understanding the Constitution, five key concepts.
The U.S. Constitution, five key concepts everyone should know, part two. And this is a continuation of part one, which you should view first. Now let's move on and talk about the three branches of government and how they're designed to operate. As we take a look at the three branches of government, this will not be a detailed analysis. That could be a multiple hour-long course, but it should be an effective overview that'll give you a sense for how the branches operate and their roles and responsibilities. First, let's take a look at the legislative branch, Congress. And as we've already said, Congress has the most space dedicated in the Constitution for describing its roles and activities. And here are some of them. They're to borrow and coin money, to regulate commerce, to regulate immigration, to set up the post office and roads, to create an environment for good commerce, to maintain army, navy, and militias, to declare war, to conduct impeachments, to oversee the District of Columbia, and to make laws limited to the six purposes of the Constitution and these areas above. And you might want to make note of the fact here that there's 10 items on this list, and this is a summary list. There's actually a few nuanced more, but it'll give you a sense for the amount of responsibility. Next, the executive, the presidential office. As we've already seen, there's less space dedicated to that, and it's reflected in his responsibilities or her responsibilities. To be commander-in-chief, to appoint ambassadors, judges, and officers, to enforce the laws of the United States, to sign treaties and receive ambassadors, to grant pardons, and to give the State of the Union to Congress. And so you can see that this list is, of items is reduced to six rather than 10. Thirdly, the judicial branch, the Supreme Court. The smallest part of the Constitution dedicated to describing its functions, which include to take appeals from citizens, courts, and states, to make principled judgments, to ensure jury trials, and to uphold the Constitution. One thing that's worth noting here as you look at the fourth item on the list, to uphold the Constitution, it's a common mistake now to think that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what the Constitution says. But in fact, how the Constitution is set up, all three branches are to uphold and to interpret the Constitution, not just the Supreme Court. Even at the founding, there was a great concern over the Supreme Court and possible judicial overreach or judicial tyranny because judges were appointed to life. And there was a feeling that the accountability judges might have or not have would allow them to encroach on the other two branches of the government over time. So concerned over this was even Jefferson at the founding said this, the Constitution is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. And so as we look at the state of things today, it seems as if these concerns have manifested themselves. The balance of power over the court, interestingly enough, is that Congress actually has the responsibility for establishing the jurisdiction of the court. They can limit what the court can actually rule on. And then Congress also has the power to impeach judges when Congress feels like they're operating outside of constitutional bounds. So in summary of these three branches, Congress was designed to be just slightly more powerful in this balance of power concept because they were closest to the people. And that's the House and then the Senate. And as you saw in the constitutional flow, that first section dedicated to Congress has the House responsibilities listed first and then the Senate. And so the even the layout of the Constitution bears out that fact. The president is powerful in war and in keeping the law. Otherwise, he plays kind of a medium role in the balance of power. And then the judiciary was designed to be the checks and balances on the other two branches, but designed to be least powerful with the least responsibilities because judges were in fact appointed for life and they knew that there was grave concern there with the possibility of a creeping judiciary over time. The last thing we want to touch base on is the Bill of Rights and how it reaffirms and limits.
All right, I've got my own clips on that. This guy's a little bit boring to listen to. 7:33, it's heading towards 103 today. Doesn't look like there's much of a chance of rain, although they're getting rain out on the border. They could get rain out on the border. Yeah, here's a little clip on the Bill of Rights. But it makes sense. John Locke is the basically the inspiration for the Constitution and Declaration in some broad sense. John Locke felt like the most important thing in a government was to represent the will of the people. So it makes sense in the balance of the government that the representational part of it, the Senate and especially the House, would have a little bit more power. And that's not how it works today. Here's a little bit on the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights is the collective name for the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution. These are a list of the natural rights of man and also a set of limitations set on the national government. The United States Constitutional Convention took place in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the Pennsylvania State House, what we know today as Independence Hall. This is the room where the United States Constitution first started to take shape. The Bill of Rights were first introduced in 1789 by James Madison as a compromise to ensure the ratification of the United States Constitution. Madison felt the Bill of Rights were necessary because other revolutionary figures like Patrick Henry argued against the Constitution, fearing that it placed too much power with the federal government and they would be able to trample the rights of man just as well as King George had done before. Still, other figures like Alexander Hamilton felt that the Bill of Rights were completely unnecessary and that even listing individual rights could be dangerous. If a right wasn't listed in the Constitution, was it really a right that was held by man? Because of the importance the Founding Fathers felt in ratifying the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights were ultimately added as the first 10 amendments. Even though the majority of delegates weren't 100% satisfied with the end result, they placed their signatures on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and both were ratified by the states. Benjamin Franklin didn't approve of every aspect of the Constitution, but felt that it was so near perfection, he encouraged all to sign. When all was said and done, the 10 amendments included the First Amendment, which dealt with the freedom of speech, the freedom of press, the freedom of religion, and also the freedom to peacefully assemble and petition the government. The Second Amendment dealt with the militia and the right to bear and keep arms. The Third Amendment dealt with protection from quartering troops. The Fourth Amendment protected citizens from unreasonable searches and seizures. The Fifth Amendment dealt with due process. The Sixth and Seventh Amendment guaranteed citizens a trial by jury in criminal and civil courts. The Eighth Amendment dealt with cruel and unusual punishments. And the Ninth Amendment stated that any right not listed in the Constitution was reserved for the people. And the Tenth Amendment gave the power to the states, which was not delegated to the national government.
All right, let's take a little break here and come back and look a little bit more at the Bill of Rights. Kelly O'Connell, 737 Fly in those friendly skies. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOB, 523-1450, and 805-6180. We'll be right back to carry on.
Honor and I went down to camp along with Captain Goodwin, and there we saw the men and boys.
And they get tasty food, and Yankee Doodle keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy. Find the music and the step, and with the girls we had.
All right, I'm kind of queuing up something here that, you know, I think I'm going to do a, right now I'm going to do the reading of the Declaration of Independence starting over, and this is a bunch of actors, a bunch of worthless actors. Check this out.
In the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes.
And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable only to tyrants.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise. The state, remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers.
He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries.
He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us.
For protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent.
For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses.
For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government,
and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government.
For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us.
We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here.
We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity.
And we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence.
They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled,
appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare
that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states.
That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown.
And that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce,
and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence,
we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Declaration of Independence right there. And we'll take a break and finish her up here. 7:49 a.m. Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, a special 4th of July broadcast for you. 523-1450 to call and 805-61802 text. We will be back to finish her up.
Like fun and sail towards the fiddle, up and ribbons red and sun all round around the middle. Keep it up, bootleg, and the dandy, find the music and the step and with the girls we had.
All right, so 7:52, and we just spent a couple of hours going over the history of the United States very briefly, and the writing of the Constitution, the Declaration, the parts of it, and such. And so I wish you happy 4th of July. You know, I've got a little bit of a clip here that you might find notable to finish up with. That I really don't have time for the whole thing, but it's kind of fascinating. Why America is a republic, not a democracy. I think this is a good way to end it. And this is from somebody called the Indocrat. Check this out.
When Benjamin Franklin exited the Constitutional Convention, he was asked by a woman, "Sir, what have you given us?" His immediate response was, "A republic, ma'am, if you can keep it." Yet most Americans today have been persuaded that our nation's governmental system is a democracy and not a republic. The difference between these two is essential in understanding Americanism and the American system. Before we discuss political systems, however, it's helpful to address the confusion that has been spread about the political spectrum. Many have been led to believe that the political spectrum places groups such as communists on the far left, fascists or dictators on the far right, and political moderates or centrists in the middle. However, a more accurate political spectrum will show government having zero power on the far right to having 100% power on the far left. At the extreme right, there is no government. The extreme left features total government under such labels as communism, socialism, Nazism, fascism, princes, potentates, dictators, kings, any form of total government. Those who claim that Nazis and fascists are right-wing never define their terms. This amounts to spreading confusion. Toward the middle of the political spectrum can be found the type of government limited to its proper role of protecting the rights of the people. That's where the Constitution of the United States is. Those who advocate such a form of government are really constitutional moderates. So let's analyze the basic forms of government. They are monarchy or dictatorship, ruled by one, oligarchy, ruled by a few, democracy, ruled by a majority, republic, ruled by law, and anarchy, which is ruled by no one. In discussing these five, we'll see that they can be narrowed down to even fewer. Looking first at monarchy or dictatorship, this form of government doesn't really exist in the practical sense. It's always a group that puts one of its members up front. A king has his council of nobles or earls, and every dictator has his bureaucrats or commissars, the men behind the scenes. This isn't ruled by one, even though one person may be the visible leader. It's ruled by a group. So let's eliminate monarchy, dictatorship, because it never truly exists. Oligarchy, which is ruled by a group, is the most common form of government in all history. And it is the most common form of government today. Most of the nations of the world are ruled by a powerful few, and therefore oligarchy remains. At the other end, we find anarchy, which means without government. Some people have looked over history and found that many of its worst crimes were committed by governments, so they decided that having no government might be a good idea. But this is a mistake, because as the ancient Greeks stated, without law there can be no freedom. Our founding fathers agreed and held that some amount of government is a necessary force in any civilized, orderly society. In a state of anarchy, however, everyone has to guard life, liberty, and property, and the lives of family members. Everyone must be armed, and movement is severely restricted because one's property has to be protected at all times. Civilized people have always hired someone to do the guarding, a sheriff, a police force, or some branch of government. Once law enforcement was in place, the people were freer. They could leave their property, work in the fields, and so on. In short, the proper amount of government makes everyone freer. There are some who advocate anarchy, however, not because they want no government, but because they don't like what they have. They use anarchy as a tool for revolutionary change. The condition of anarchy is very much like a vacuum where something rushes in to fill it. These calculating anarchists work to break down the existing government with rioting, killing, looting, and terrorism. Tragically, the people living in such chaos often go to those best able to put an end to it,
and beg them to take over and restore order. And who was best able to put an end to the chaos? The very people who started it. The anarchists who created the problem then create a government run by them, an oligarchy, where they have total power. This is exactly what happened in Russia that led to Lenin taking total power, and in Germany, where Hitler's brown shirts created the chaos that brought him to power. But anarchy isn't a stable form of government. It's a quick transition from something that exists to something desired by the power hungry. It's a temporary condition, and because it isn't permanent, we eliminate it as well. The word democracy comes from two Greek words, demos, meaning people, and kratian, meaning to rule. Democracy, therefore, means the rule of the people, majority rule. This, of course, sounds good, but suppose the majority decides to take away one's home or business.
Well, we're running out of time here, but the name of this is Why America is a Republic, Not a Democracy. You can find it on YouTube, and it is excellent. Well, thanks for joining me today, and really, the 4th of July, you know, the very, very special day in America and the most special country in the world. Don't let anybody tell you any differently. And we've got our work cut out for us in these next few decades to try to get a rein on the radical Islam that is bursting out across the globe, and also to tamp down the unrest of the far leftists in this country. So we need the hand of God to guide us on that one. 7:59, and I'll take you out with some Yankee Doodle Dandy. Have a great, hope you get some great food and a few nice fireworks. See you back in 22 hours. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450 KOBE. Ciao. Happy 4th.
And there I see a little kick, his head were made of leather, they knocked the pole with little sticks.
To call a friend together, Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle, dandy. Find the music and the step, and with the girl behind me.